In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Stevens Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
It's coolest conversations time in Little Stevens Underground Garage, presented by Hard Rock. I'm the Mighty Manfred. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. My guest is Rhett Miller, singer, guitarist, and principal songwriter in the long-running alt-country band, The Old 97s. Their latest album is American Primitive, and it features our recent coolest song in the world, Falling Down. I'll play a portion of that, followed by my talk with Rhett on your coolest conversations presented by Hard Rock in Little Stevens Underground Garage.
Like the world is falling down around you, because it is, because it is. And if you're lucky enough that happiness has found you, you better get to dancing as your way of saying thank you. For the spider web of the electrical wires and the patches of the grass that are still green,
Mighty Manfred here, and it's time now to get chatting with Rhett Miller, singer, songwriter, and musician of the alt-country band The Old 97s. Their latest album, American Primitive, is home to our recent coolest song of the world, Falling Down. How are you, Rhett?
I'm great. How are you doing, Manfred?
Excellent. I'm doing excellent because I'm happy to be chatting with you.
Nice.
So, you guys began in Dallas. Now, are you still there? Where do you live these days?
Two of our band members are still there. Our drummer and our guitar player, Philip and Ken, respectively, still live in the Lake Highlands neighborhood of Dallas and love it. I moved out in the late 90s, 98, and my bass player, Murray, moved out not long after. I wound up about 20 years ago in New York's Hudson Valley, where I still live and have raised a couple of kids. And Murray moved to Pasadena, California, not far from maybe where you are at this very moment. Years ago, and in the last year, he just, because his son matriculated off to college, Murray just moved up to the Pacific Northwest. So we are as far away from each other as we could possibly be and still love each other.
Right. That's how you can maintain being in a band.
Yeah. 31 years now. Same four guys.
Well, you know, I'm sure when you get back together and somebody passes gas, you know who it is, right? And you can say, I told you not to eat that.
It's usually Ken, and yes. Yeah.
Well, so when your bass player was here in Pasadena, yeah, I'm about 15 minutes from there. So I was thinking, you know, I could go over and tap on his window or something, but it's a much longer trek for me to run up to the Pacific Northwest, so I guess he's escaped.
Well, he and I are going to meet up in a few weeks and I'm going to make a solo record, and Murray, the Old 97s bassist, Murray is going to fly down. We're going to be in North Hollywood recording a record for me, which is hilarious because Murray produced my very first ever record that I made when I was in high school. I was 17 years old, and here we are now, years later, and Murray's producing this solo record for me.
So, and well, let's go ahead and talk some about y'all's relationship, because he's been with you a long time. When did you guys first meet?
We met, I was 15 years old, and I was dating a girl named Jennifer, and he was dating a different girl named Jennifer, and they were friends, best friends, and they said to each other, you guys would like our boyfriends, and they put us together, and he recorded the very, very first demos I ever made. He recorded them in his living room. He's like 8 years older than me, so he was my mentor. He taught me how to do all the music stuff and all the smoking out of bongs stuff, you know, just all the stuff.
He was the introduction to rock and roll.
Yeah, very much. He was in a band. He was in a band at the time called Peyote Cowboys, and they were a great psychedelic, garage psychedelic band. So incredible. Such a great band.
Well, now yourself, I read that you had started taking guitar lessons at the age of 12. Is that correct?
Yeah, it didn't stick till I turned 13 because it was hurting my fingers. But I was like, I got to write songs and I'm not going to write them on the piano.
Did you play piano already, or had you taken lessons for that?
I tried to teach myself, and my brother had taught himself and he was really good at it. But I don't know. The guitar is my vibe. You can stand up, you can dance around.
And you mentioned your brother. So you have a couple of siblings or just the one brother?
I have a younger brother and a younger sister, and even though my brother's like the CEO of a big, you know, fancy company, he still plays every instrument way better than me, and we look exactly the same. And my sister's a big music lover. She worked at ASCAP and a bunch of record labels and lives down in Austin, goes to concerts all the time, and they're very cool. We've stayed real close.
And your folks then, I mean, like growing up, was there a lot of music at the household, or did your parents play, or were they just big fans?
Yeah, my dad is a lawyer and a music fan, a big music fan. But my mom sings like a bird and had this dream of being a backup singer. And she never followed it. She wound up raising the three of us, but still to this day sings great and, you know, introduced me to choir and would take me around. And I wasn't, you know, a very churchy kid, but I wound up in church a lot of days out of every week because I was singing in like two or three different choirs at any given moment during my childhood, and love it. I still love the idea of standing there with a bunch of people singing. I think it's a great thing for kids to do. Yeah, my mom was a great influence in that.
Well, I know that this, you know, when you were like, when did you say you met Murray? When was that?
I was 15.
15. Okay. Well, I know like at 14, there was a very difficult time for you. You were at this private boys school in Dallas, and a very difficult environment there. And you attempted suicide when you were 14.
Yeah, but I wouldn't blame the environment at this St. Mark's school where I went. It's a great school. I just, that age is such a hard age, having gone through it myself and gone through it with other kids. And now I've, you know, come out the other side, and I've tried to do some work with the Suicide Prevention Network and just tried to raise awareness and tried to destigmatize the conversation around mental health, especially for teens. That's a hard time with your hormones hitting like they are and social pressures. Yeah, I'm really lucky that I survived it. Yeah.
And so I was wondering, so you had been taking lessons. I mean, how did music work in, you know, sort of in getting through that period to recovering? What role did that play? I know you're also like a writer, but specifically I was interested in more the music aspect there.
Yeah, I remember coming to in the hospital the morning after they had taken me in, and they couldn't pump my stomach. They had to induce vomiting. But basically I woke up surprised to be alive after ODing on all these different things. And I was immediately singing a song. Like my first memory that morning, you know, this sort of second lease on life, was I was singing a song, and I just, from that moment forward, that it was so obvious to me. You know, my big problem had been the night before, specifically, had been the idea that there's no meaning to all of this. We just do it and do it, and then we die, you know. And that morning, I remember when I woke up, I was real clear in my mind that there was a meaning, and the meaning for me was music, to create it, to listen to it, to try and live a life built on music. And that's what I've done for all these decades since.
Well, I really appreciate you, you know,
going with me here and talking about this, because there's a track specifically on the album that Where the Road Goes, where you have this line, oh, you could have died that day back when you thought none of this was worth it, when you thought everything was broken. I was wondering, is that a direct reference to that period in your life, or is it more general?
Yes, it is. I let myself go there. I'd gotten hired to go out and sing for some rich people out in Montana at a fancy resort. And so I brought my family and we were in this really beautiful place that, you know, the music career doesn't always afford you that kind of luxury, but sometimes the perks might bring it to you. So we were in Montana. It was so beautiful. My kids were there. My wife was there. I got overcome by gratitude, which I know is corny. And I even when I was writing that song, I almost stopped because I was like, oh God, nobody wants to hear me be grateful. Ugh, barf. But I gave myself permission to go there, which I think now that I'm teaching songwriting at college and doing all these songwriting retreats that I'm leading, one of the biggest things I'll tell people is, you know, give yourself permission to finish the song, even if you feel embarrassed. Usually that's a good sign, you know, usually it means you're being vulnerable. You're going to a place that, you know, the voices in your head don't want you to go there. And so gave myself permission to sort of be grateful in a song. And I thought, even if it's stupid, I can just keep it, throw it away, whatever. But I felt like it wound up being pretty good. And I thought, again, let's destigmatize all these conversations. Even if, you know, the conversation is, oh, look how lucky I am to be alive right now. That's kind of sweet. So I feel like it wound up being a pretty good song.
Oh, yeah, I agree 100%. Let's talk some more about the album. I was read that it was that there were no pre-production was done and that you just kind of showed up at the studio and started banging out some tunes. Is that really the case?
It's so funny, you know, being on Underground Garage, because this station in particular, I feel like is such a touchstone for our band. We go into the studio every time and we say, oh, we've got, like, I usually bring in about 40 songs and then Murray will bring in his little pile of songs. So usually I've got 10 songs on the record and Murray has 2 songs on the record. And so we've got all these songs and it could go any way. Like, you look at the songs, and in this case, we did not do pre-production. So nobody really knew going in what songs we were going to do. And so the conversation is always this, man, should we really lean into, like, you know, our roots, and you know, we should we try and make a record that's gonna, you know, kiss a little Americana ass, and we can make one of those, like, kind of play a bunch of fiddles and some pedal steel. And then we look at each other and we go, oh, we're just, all we are is a garage band, and it's the thing that makes us different. It's the thing that we're best at. So why not lean into it? So once again, and it helped that I had just seen the Pixies play up in Boston the day before I went to make this record. And I looked at the Pixies on stage, you know, decades into their career. They took a break, but still, I'm friends with those guys. I love what they do. They still just lean into their weirdness. I thought, let's do that. Let's just lean into this thing that makes the old 97s what we are, which is this weird, loud band with these big single note guitar lines, like on Falling Down Around You. That, you know, that guitar part to me is so juicy. And, forget fiddles and pedal steel. Maybe someday we'll do that. But for now, we're just going to be the weird garage band that we are. And it was so fun making this record because, once again, we gave ourselves permission to go there.
Well, tell me about this guy that engineered and produced it, Tucker. And how do you pronounce his last name? Is Martin or Martine?
Tucker Martine, yep, in Portland, Oregon. He's produced a bunch of, you know, Decemberist records and Nico Case records and on and on. He's an incredible producer, but he doesn't do a lot. Like, he makes a good vibe. He'll nudge you here and there. He captures, at least for us, this is how he worked, captures the sounds on the fly in a way that makes them sound real good. And he's just a really sweet dude. And although he doesn't fight with you a lot, like, every once in a while he'll say, you know, what if you tried doing that chorus twice? But other than that, you're not getting a lot of, you know, push from him, which for us was great this time around.
And so he was game to this idea of, you know, no pre-production. We're just going to get in there and kind of figure it out when we're all together.
I think for a producer, a lot of times that's a nice way to go because we don't have everything answered ahead of time. Yeah, so he's able to be a part of the song as it gets figured out. And yeah, he was kind of up for anything. I bet if we'd have showed up with a much stronger idea and a lot of hours spent in a rehearsal room, he would have been fine with that as well. But this offered him more of an opportunity to be on the, you know, the ground floor building the songs.
Well, you mentioned Falling Down and the guitar in there. And what I love, it, you know, it kicks off the album. And it also has got this straight to sort of this Dick Dale kind of vibe, you know, complete with a surf beat just at the top of the song. And you referenced, you know, you guys being a kind of a garage band or having those roots. Are you much of a surf music fan?
Yeah. And that's always been a big point of reference with Ken, our guitar player. You know, he's there's a similarity, an overlap between surf music and rockabilly music. It's, you know, the vibe is kind of similar, and the way the guitar works in the song is sort of a, you know, such a lead melody instrument, the sort of the backbone of those songs. And I know Ken did time in rockabilly bands, as did Philip, our drummer. In our earliest incarnation, or in the earliest days of the old 97s, on our first couple of records, you can hear a lot of surf influence and a lot of rockabilly influence. And, you know, it's a big part of who we are. And I listen to that song and I hear Joey Santiago from the Pixies in the way that he approaches the guitar, and, you know, what Ken, our guitar player, and I love so much about him. In fact, when we've got a rough mix of that song, I sent it to Joe and I just said, just running this by you, and this feels very Joey Santiago to me. I want to make sure we're not like ripping you off. And he gave me the go ahead. He gave me legal binding permission to release the song.
So in that song, Falling Down, is that one of the ones that you kind of came into the session with?
Oh yeah, I came in with all of the songs. Nothing got written in the room. We were working too fast for me. I did finish some lyrics. I polished up some songs and I defanged a couple of songs. In fact, that song, Falling Down Around You, had a giant F-bomb in the chorus that was fun. You know, it's instead of saying because it is, it was because it effing is, over and over again. So, you know, it was a lot. And I sent it to my sister Christy down in Austin, and she called me and she goes, you got to take the F-bomb out of this chorus. It's such a great song and I can't listen to it with my kids in the car. And I thought, well, I mean, that's not really the rules I'm living by. But I thought about it and I realized it was almost more effective without the constant sort of going all the way there. Sometimes when I play it live, I'll sing it still.
So another fave tune of mine on the album is Honey Pie. And that's got one of my favorite lyric lines in there. When we met we were fresh and green, shiny as a page in a magazine, which you've got really great imagery with a lot of your lyrics, so this is pretty simple straight ahead, but I just love that line because for me it's so easy to visualize those shiny pages in a magazine, and so it winds up, you know, really resonating with me.
Thanks. Yeah, my wife was nervous about that song because it seems very much like it's a moment between us, because I do. I sometimes I'll call her my old lady just because I always thought that was kind of a funny 70s sort of way to refer to your partner. I don't know. I got to ask my old lady. And as we've gotten older, she's less excited about that as a nickname. So I didn't think the band would be into that song, but when somebody, it might've been Tucker, the producer, brought it up. He said, it feels like a Faces jam. You know, it feels like one of those back porch kind of Faces, songs, and bringing in, you know, we had Peter Buck played a mandolin on that song, which was so great. And we had Scott McCoy played piano on that. And between the two of those elements, it really, to me, landed as like a really great, fun, lighthearted answer to some of the stuff on the record that's a little more rocking and in your face or a little darker. I thought it was great. You need that on records. You need the yin and the yang, I feel like.
Well, so mentioning Peter, he also plays, I think, on Where the Road Goes and Incantation. When did you meet those guys? How did you get them on the record?
Golly, you know, we got asked to open for REM, which, you know, in a band, you'll have a few names that you can agree on. For us in the old 97s, as the four of us band members, like, we could always agree on X, we could always agree on The Clash, Hank Sr., and REM. In fact, REM was probably the one that we most modeled our band after. We decided we would share our publishing because REM shared their publishing. We just, you know, like, so many of the choices we made in the earliest days of our bands and throughout our band's history, even beyond musically, were based on REM. And so getting asked to open for them on one of their final ever US shows that they did, and getting to hang out with those guys, and then they've come to our gigs over the years, and I've gotten to go down to Mexico and play on some festivals that Peter used to put on. Just getting to be friends with those guys has really been a dream come true. It's one of the coolest things about this job, is realizing that your heroes are also just people, and probably they're, you know, these really fantastic people that you can be friends with. And so getting to be friends with them is great. Hearing Peter play that arpeggiated 12-string electric guitar, Rickenbacker, of course, on Where the Road Goes, was one of the coolest moments of my life. Like, I had written this song, and I'm sitting 3 feet away from him, and he's recording the most Peter Buck sounding thing you could imagine on a song that I wrote. It really felt full circle. It really felt like I had kind of lived the life that I dreamed of as a kid.
How do you pronounce the last song in the album?
Was it Estuviera Cayendo? It's basically... Yes. Falling down in Spanish.
Okay. And so I was looking at credits online. This Jeff Trapp playing flamenco guitar on it. Is that correct?
Yeah. And it's none of us. I mean, it's based on Falling Down, the opening song of the record. And then Jeff Trapp, who is an incredible guitar player, and he'll slum it selling merch for the old 97s, but he's been in bands over the years. He's been in a lot of bands, you know, big rock bands. But then the last 15 years or so, he has been going to Spain every year and studying with a maestro and becoming this incredible flamenco guitarist, which you wouldn't guess. He's this tall, skinny, redheaded, you know, rock and roll kid. I mean, he's, you know, my age. But so he's this incredible flamenco guitarist, and I got it in my brain. How cool would it be if the record closed with a reprise of that first song on the record, but like a flamenco version? And I challenged Jeff to create that, to write that song. And it's him. He wrote that, and he plays it in one take. And it's so beautiful, and none of us had anything to do with it except me basically writing the song it's based on.
Very cool. I wanted to ask you... about something you did, I guess, a couple of years ago. But first, when you were a kid, were you much into reading comic books?
Yeah, I wasn't as a cool kid that would read, like, the, you know, superhero comic books. I kind of liked the dorkier, you know, joke Archie, you know, kind of comic books when I was really young. It was pretty much all music by the time I was 13. But yeah, I liked little comic books.
Well, the reason I ask that is that you guys... wound up in that Guardians of the Galaxy Christmas special. And I was wondering, how did that happen?
James Gunn, who's the brains behind Guardians, is the auteur, writes them and directs them all, is an old 97s fan from way back. He was in bands too, actually, James was. But he and I have been friends since we met at a publishing, like, was it Warner Chappell or whatever publisher I was on at the time, like 15 years ago. Had an event, and James was there as a director, and he was about to put our song, I think, Big Brown Eyes, over the closing credits of his first big movie, Slither. Not big, his first indie horror film, Slither. And so he had our song in his thing. He told me about it at this event. We got to be friends and stayed friends, and I watched his ascent, you know, which is so... To me, is such a perfect example of how it should be done. Like, he worked his ass off. He wrote a novel. He wrote screenplay after screenplay after screenplay. He made, you know, smaller movies, and then, you know, gradually worked his way up to becoming the, you know, the head of the Guardians franchise. And now he's the head of DC. And he's just such a brilliant man. And I went to visit him on the set at Suicide Squad in Peachtree, Georgia. And that day on the set, they had built a rainforest inside this warehouse, which is incredible already. And I was sitting there in Video Village with all the directors and assistant directors and all that. And they were filming, watching him work. And then as each actor would come out, you know, these, it was Idris Elba and Margot Robbie and John Cena. And they would all come off the set. And as they would walk through, he would introduce me to each of them. And he would say, "This is Rhett Miller. He's the singer of the greatest rock and roll band in the world." And I was like, oh, man, I guess I didn't really realize, you know, where I sat in his, for him, you know, because I always thought he was such a sweet, cool guy. So at the end of that day, and again, this is really a lesson in do things that scare you. I told him something I never told him before. I just said, I love your work. And if there's ever space for me to work with you, you know, beyond just hanging out and being friends, I would love to do something, anything in your world. I'd love it. And 6 months later, he called and he said, "Would you and the guys be willing to be aliens in the Guardians of the Galaxy?" And I was like, "Yeah, duh, let's go." And the rest is history.
The song that you're doing, I don't know what Christmas is, but Christmas time is here. Now, who wrote that?
I wrote that with James. He had the scene in his brain. My alien character, Beezer McAtalkalock, would be confronting Chris Pratt's character, Star-Lord, and saying, "I've got the song." He's basically, my character is basically a Earth fanboy. So I really just want to ask Chris Pratt, are all the details in this song about your Earth holiday, are they right? And so James and I were going to write a song where I was getting everything wrong, basically. And the idea originally was that it was going to be really violent and really just like way over the line. And so we wrote about 7 versions of this song, and every one of them, I would send him this version. It would have lyrics like, "Santa's suit is drenched in blood as he, you know, like he peels the bad kids' faces off." It was really messed up. And so we kept giving them to Disney, of course. And then Disney kept saying, "Are you crazy? This is not Disney material." And what we wound up with was not a watered down version, but a more Disney-fied version of the song that we wrote 7 times over. The early version, someday I would like to release an album of all the early versions of the song. They're so gnarly, Manfred. You'd love it.
Well, I'm looking forward to hearing that. You can just send it right to me.
Okay.
All right. So another cool thing that's going on here. Well, so I've never been on a cruise, but I will next year when, you know, Little Steven's cruise inaugural Underground Garage cruise sets sail. It's like the 9th through the 13th going from Miami to Nassau. You guys are going to be on the big boats, but you are also veterans of outlaw country cruises. Now, first of all, how many of those have you done?
Oh, man. So I did a couple of cruises before the band got asked to do the Outlaw cruise. I did, a jam band cruise called Rombello. I did a cruise called Kayamo that was really fun, although it skews a little sort of more quiet. And then we started doing the Outlaw Country cruises. And we've done at this point 4 or 5 of those over the years. And it's so fun because you're just on a boat walking around, seeing the best music possible day after day, hanging out with other people that love music and other musicians. The Outlaw Country cruise has been great, but this Underground Garage cruise, you know, features some of my favorite bands and some really close friends. The fact that X is on this boat and I'll get to hang out with John Doe, and Exene, it's going to be such a blast, y'all.
Well, what do you have any advice for a newbie like myself? Because I've never been on any cruise.
Well, there is this thing you can buy, order online. It's like, it looks like a watch, and it shoots these little electrical impulses into your wrist, and it keeps you from getting motion sickness. Not everybody gets it, but you don't want to get all the way out there on the boat and find out that you are one of the people that does get it. So I would recommend getting that, just to have it in a couple of extra batteries, so that just in case you start to get a little bit of, because you don't know what the weather's going to be like. When the boat docks, make sure you get off the boat for that one day, because it's so fun just to get on dry land and see some beautiful island for a minute. But yeah, other than that, just enjoy it, man. Wake up early, watch the sunrise, watch the sunset, see the music, eat the food, get your hands sprayed by sanitizer every time you walk in and out of one of the dining facilities. It's pretty fun.
Excellent. Well,
So today's Friday. Tonight, let's see, Friday, November 8th, you're playing the Longhorn Ballroom in Dallas with Fastball. We do a couple of other shows with them as well. So Fastball, they're longtime buddies of yours.
Yeah. And I remember the first time I ever heard their song, The Way, and I was living in LA and we were on still on Elektra at the time and kind of getting the pressure to how could the old 97s make a song that could be on the radio? And I'm like, I don't know. That's not really a question I even care to try and answer. You know, I just write songs. We do what we do. This is who we are. And I remember hearing that Fastball song, The Way, come on the radio in a public space in LA. And I just sat down and listened to it. And I thought, this is how a Texas band makes a song that sounds like a classic and gets played on the radio. They just nailed it. And, you know, they've got so many great songs and great records, and I love them. And the fact that we're going to get to be playing together at the Longhorn Ballroom, where Murray and I, back in 1986, went on our very first ever bro date together to see the Ramones play. That's just, what a great night.
So this was the two Jennifers who put you together, and right after that, you guys were hanging out a lot.
Yeah, and we both wore our black leather motorcycle jackets to Longhorn Ballroom, where years earlier the Sex Pistols had played, and there's the Ramones up there on stage, and we're just rocking out, and that cemented our friendship, and that was 40 years ago.
So how often do you play Dallas?
We, it's the way major markets work for a band like us. Even if it's your hometown, you get to play there once, maybe twice a year. So I just did my annual cystic fibrosis benefit solo. I did a little song swap with Todd, Vaden, and Lewis from the Toadies and our friend Sarah Jaffe. Got up there and raised a bunch of money to help cure cystic fibrosis. So I'll do that once a year. The band will play once a year, and maybe we'll sneak in something else around Dallas at some point. I wish we could get back more. I go back a lot and visit my mom and my brother and his family.
Well, we're going to go out now with another track off the album, Chase the Setting Sun, very jaunty number. Now, did you say that this is one of Murray's contributions?
Yeah. So Murray, our bass player, who now, by the way, is also in the band The Long Riders. But so he's doing double duty now, which is incredible that he's in this, historic kick-ass, Americana, proto-Americana band from L.A. in the 80s. Murray gets to tour around with them. Murray writes a lot of songs. He produces records. Like I said, he's producing my next record. And he gets about a couple of songs. I hog most of the real estate, but Murray gets a couple of songs in every old 97s record, and I love him, and people love him. He's got so many great, great songs, and this is one of them, Chase the Setting Sun.
Well, Rhett, thank you so much for chatting with me today on Our Coolest Conversations.
Man, thank you so much, Manfred, for doing everything you do, and I love Underground Garage.
All right, well, we're going to give Chase the Setting Sun a spin now. It's the old 97s off American Primitive and Little Steven's Underground Garage.
In the stories of our sweet, sweet love, my favorite was the end. Somehow I chewed right through the rope and hit the ground again. She's going back to mom and pa with tales of what was done. Saying that right from the start, I chased the setting sun. Setting sun. You can tell them all about me when I'm done. Setting sun. You can tell them all about me, how I chased the setting sun.
From the old 97s, that's some of their tune, Chased the Setting Sun. The cut is off their latest album, American Primitive. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to the band's Rhett Miller for speaking with me today on Our Coolest Conversations. Thanks also to Sammy Semenza for producing and Kurt Baker for editing. English singer-songwriter Nick Lowe, he scored pop hits on this side of the Atlantic, and also is well-known and well-regarded as a producer, having worked with the likes of Elvis Costello, The Damned, Graham Parker, The Pretenders, Johnny Cash, and others. He's also still recording and releasing albums. His latest is called Indoor Safari and features him backed by Lost Straitjackets. Nick's going to join us our next time around to tell us all about the latest release and his career in general. That's Nick Lowe on our next Coolest Conversations presented by Hard Rock and Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Oh. Buddy, you're a boy. Make a big noise playing in the street. I'm gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace. Kicking your can all over the place.
Some things are better when they rock. The Seminole Hard Rock Hotels and Casinos rock around the clock with nonstop casino action, rooms fit for the king, pools, spas, restaurants, and clubs for every taste and temptation. Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa or Hollywood, Florida. We will rock you.